Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre as part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world listening on the internet. Our guest this week is Glenn Vowles. He's going to talk about green issues. And our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Me, in fact. Malcolm Greaves reads a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. And Trevor Carter, our resident bard, reads his latest poem. Jeff Sparks is back here too for his What's On Guide and Song of the Week. And our theme this week is the 1960s, 1964 to be precise. Later on in the show, we have an interview with Anthony and Alison Smith. They were the couple who agreed to be filmed in their own home for a documentary about Bristol in the year 1964. John Borman produced the six programmes to launch BBC Two. The six half-hour episodes of The Newcomers, which is the title of the documentary, were later recut to 50 minutes for BBC One. The music we're going to play tonight is from the 1960s, and the first one is Cilla Black, who had a hit in 1964 called Anyone Who Had a Heart.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so, anyone who had a heart would take me in his arms and love me too. Who couldn't be another heart that hurt me like you hurt me and be so untrue? What am I to do every time you go away? I always say, this time it's goodbye, dear. Loving you the way I do, I take you back. Without you, I'd die, dear. Knowing I
That was Cilla Black singing Anyone Who Had a Heart. Now over to our guest, Glenn Vowles. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
Now, you are a Green Party person, aren't you? What's your connection with the Greens?
I've been a member of the Green Party for over 25 years. I was a founder member of Bristol's South Green Party.
And were you standing in the recent election?
Yes, Bristol East and in Knowle.
And how did you get it on?
Hundreds of votes. Hundreds of votes. But I'm more pleased to get a councillor elected in Bristol, in Southville, and also our first MP at Westminster. So it was, well, historic.
Now, you have been knocked into, I think, is it fourth place by the BNP in one or two places around Bristol. This is a bit worrying, isn't it?
Very dispiriting. If I was behind the BNP in Bristol East, and we were behind the BNP in Bristol South too. It happened in a lot of places across the country, actually.
But it seems that where the BNP have won seats, like in Barking, is they've actually been kicked out. It's a bit bizarre, isn't it?
They're actually virtually wiped out at local government level, which is very nice to see.
They're able to get close, but then you've got more staying power, I think, the Greens. Can you tell us about the origins of the party? Because it started as the Ecology Party, didn't it?
Well, it actually goes back before that. The party was first called People, I believe, in the very, very early
The People's
days.
Party.
The People's Party, yeah. And then changed its name very quickly to the Ecology Party in 1972. Pretty much with the same kind of manifesto as now. People have been talking now about the kind of relaunch of the Green Party. It's actually got some economic and social policies in addition to the environmentalism, but actually they've been there since the 1970s, and people seem to have suddenly discovered the fact that you stand for all these things.
So why was it that this is something that kind of came out of the 60s?
The consumerism was really building after during the 50s and after this and on into the 60s. Economy was booming, consumption rising. So the roots of the 21st century, mass consumption production are there in the 50s and then into the 60s, and the more you consume, the more you waste, and the more you pollute, and therefore the bigger your impact on the environment. So there is a connection intimately between your economic policies and your impact on the environment. It's there. It's inherent in the system. Basically.
Now, a lot of the other parties, I think you'd say, probably borrowed their ideas from the Greens. Do you find this a little bit frustrating?
Yeah, I don't believe a word of it. They might bolt on a few of the more attractive Green policies. You judge them by their actions. Are we more a greener society now than we were in 1997 when Tony Blair was elected? Not one bit. Not one bit, not by any measure that I can think of.
What about recycling, for example? I mean, yeah. Bristol's now recycling a lot more than it was, back in the mid-90s, surely.
It's better in some of the easier ways. It's what I describe it as, people have gone for the low-hanging fruit, the easier things to pick, if you see what I mean. And it's easy to put out your bottles and recycle your cans and your newspapers. It's difficult to reduce your consumption because that has implications for your wealth levels and so on. It's difficult to share wealth out more fairly. If you look at that, it's an obscene fact, at least to me, it's an obscene fact that if you compare 1997 with now, the richest 10% earn 100 times more than the poorest 10%. For me, that's a green issue as much as how much you're recycling your bottles or your cans.
Now, recycling is one thing, but you're saying that that's really not enough. If you were Prime Minister, apart from having your hands tied by the City of London behind your back, what would you like to see? What would you like to see that would make a bigger difference to society than just something as simple as recycling?
That's a really good question. You need to get to the heart of the matter. So I changed some fundamentals about how we're actually measuring progress in society, measuring progress in the economy. I don't know if you know, but the way we do our national accounts, we only add. It's not like a normal accounting process where you add up the pluses and you take away the minuses and you end up with a net figure. That's your growth in the economy. You only add the money flow. So take a nice oil spill from the 1960s at the Torrey Canyon, or take the current oil spill off the coast of America. That will actually increase, by measures of progress in society that we use, that will actually increase economic growth and actually count as a plus in our society, because it generates just 13,000 people working on clearing up the oil spill in America. But is the oil spill a good thing? It generates plenty of economic activity, but it's obviously not a good thing. So I would suggest you take away that the cost of the oil spill from your economic growth. You do proper accounts and have a plus column and a minus column, or something similar. You know, you change some fundamentals about the way you measure progress.
So if you're not going to use these sort of economic indicators, which you think are, you know, distorted, what else can you use to see whether a society is doing well or not?
Yeah, you change the goals that it's not just about the indicators, it's about changing the goal of economic policy.
Okay, so what should the goal be then?
Goal should be that we should operate with a certain efficiency, an ever increasing efficiency. On renewable resources rather than those that will run out, and an economy that operates within the limits of the environment is actually enhancing equality of income, for instance, instead of widening the inequalities.
So you mentioned briefly your day job. What is your day job?
I'm a lecturer with the Open University. I don't know whether that comes across in the way I talk about
these subjects.
Environmental decision making.
Okay.
And environmental studies.
So you must be quite pleased to have the first Green MP in Parliament after the last election. Do you think it's really going to make any difference? There's only one MP, Caroline Lucas, from Brighton.
I don't think there's going to be anybody else in Parliament asking questions as an environmentalist, because we are environmentalists, but asking fundamental questions about the way we measure progress in the economy, for instance. I mean, David Cameron might claim to have some green credentials, and so might Nick Clegg,
but he rides a bike, doesn't he?
None of them, yeah, followed by his car with his shoes in the back. Yeah, so I don't see any fundamental change from the kind of economic policies we've had over the last 13 years, to be quite honest. That wasn't a very progressive government, even though it was a Labour government. And I come from a Labour family originally, even though I'm green now. And I think it's shameful. That new Labour thinking has been rather shameful. To allow for a Labour government, I say this at public meetings, repeat the word, a Labour government, to allow wealth inequality to rise such that the richest 10% can earn 100 times more than the poorest 10%. And that is as green an issue as, you know, whether you're recycling your bottles or cleaning up an oil spill.
Okay, Glenn Vowles from the South Bristol Green Party, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Another track now from the 60s, the Dave Clark 5, Glad All Over.
Glad all over, baby, I'm glad all over, so glad you're mine.
That was the Dave Clark Five and Glad All Over. In a minute, Clegg and Cameron and my take on Mr Cameron's new cabinet. But before that, we're going to play a short clip from Harold Wilson's speech at the Labour conference in 1963. Harold Wilson became Prime Minister the year after, in 1964.
By the autumn of 1963, the Tory party was looking tired after 12 years in office. It had a Grouse Moore image and was beset by scandals. A youngish Harold Wilson was now leading the Labour Party, and at his party conference, he inspired the delegates with a vision of a science-based, technocratic future.
Mr. Chairman, let me conclude with what I think the message of all this is for this conference. Because in this conference, in all our plans for the future, we are redefining and we are restating our socialism in terms of the scientific revolution. But that revolution cannot become a reality unless we are prepared to make far-reaching changes in economic and social attitudes which permeate our whole system of society. The Britain that is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution will be no place for restrictive practices or for outdated methods on either side of industry. Then again, Mr. Chairman, in the cabinet room and the boardroom alike, those charged with the control of our affairs must be ready to think and to speak in the language of our scientific age. For the commanding heights of British industry to be controlled today by men whose only claim is their aristocratic connection, or the power of inherited wealth, or speculative finance, is as irrelevant to the 20th century as would be the continued purchase of commissions in the armed forces by lordly amateurs. At the very time that even the MCC has abolished the distinction between amateurs and professionals, in science and in industry, we are content to remain a nation of gentlemen in a world of players.
That was Harold Wilson speaking in 1963, the year before he became Prime Minister. Well, Trevor Carter is going to grill me now about their new cabinet, the new Conservative cabinet led by David Cameron. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Tony. So you'll have some enlightenment to the electorate to throw on this the new government.
Yeah? Well, yeah, I'm a bit suspicious about some of the characters in David Cameron's new cabinet because they're connected with various of these secret clubs. The first one, which I think we should know about, is this club from Oxford called the Bullingdon Club.
Yes, there's been quite a lot about that. That's not a secret, is it? I think a lot of people have heard
well,
about
well, what they actually the get Bullingdon up to Club. Is secret because a lot of it is criminal. And what happens is at the beginning of the term, each year at Oxford, several of the new recruits, the new students, will get told, would you like to join this club? And they're kind of asked, it's not something you can go along and say, I want to be part of the Bullingdon Club. They are asked to join
only,
it.
Yeah.
Invitation only.
Yes.
And I just wanted to look at some of the figures that have been part of that club during the years that George Osborne and David Cameron were at Oxford, because they were both members of the Bullingdon Club. It's first of all, if you look through some of the people who were in the club with them, we've got the Honourable Edward Sebastian Grigg. He is the current chairman of the Credit Suisse Bank in Britain. Then obviously there's David Cameron, Ewan Ferguson, who many people will have heard of. Then there's Jonathan Ford. And for me, the most interesting thing is some of these people, Jonathan Ford, who's he? Well, it turns out that he's one of the senior partners at Morgan Grenfell Bank.
Yes.
Boris Johnson, we've all heard of. He was also in the Bullingdon Club, the then president of the Oxford Union back in the day, and he's now Lord Mayor of London. Then there's the 1992 set of the Bullingdons. There's George Osborne, who's now the Shadow Chancellor. The writer Harry Mount. Have you ever heard of him? You being a writer yourself?
I've heard of some of these names. Well, what's your specific concern with the? I mean, obviously they've got this sort of list of characters.
A lot of them seem to have done incredibly well, just because they're connections. And I think this is one of the things that that I dislike about this whole sort of attitude to politics and banking, particularly, is that so many of these people seem to get their success in life through being part of one of these little fraternities at the university, rather than through on their merits. And I don't know about you, Trevor, but looking at some of the characters that are running our banking system, I do wonder if they're really the best people for the job when they've managed through nepotism or whatever to get there by that means.
Yeah, well, as you know, I mean, I do have strong feelings about the whole banking scene, and I've written quite a lot of things about, you know, relating to that for the programmes in recent months. But having said that, I mean, aren't these people? Isn't the Bullingdon Club just an extension of a fraternity that would, to a large extent, exist anyway? So, or do you think there's something seedy?
Well, it is particularly seedy.
About it, and yeah, so what? Really,
well, what is the criminality? Because they are quite good at having these sort of. They're essentially a dining club, but what they then get up to is. I think I'm right in saying that they're still not allowed to dine anymore within 15 miles of Oxford because of so many establishments that they've actually smashed up during their rather rowdy meals. Yeah. And as a result, they're usually cautioned by the police the day afterwards. Yeah, so there'll be a little bit of a kerfuffle, and then it's a sort of very gentle slap on the wrist, whereas most of us at lobbed bricks through windows would expect rather more harsh treatment, quite rightly, from the police for those sorts of acts.
So this kind of undue deference, which is is a kind of corruption then, isn't it? I mean, it's clearly obviously.
I couldn't possibly comment on whether it's corrupt or not.
If that is the case.
But since you've got your love of bankers, you'll love to hear that the son of the Lloyd's chairman, David Coleridge, Chris Coleridge, was also a Bullingdon Club member, as is or was Nat Rothschild, the heir to the Baron's Rothschild fortune. And as well as Michael Gove, who's Shadow Secretary of State for Children, he was also a member of this Bullingdon Club, and the founder of the far-right think tank Policy Exchange, who were caught doing dirty tricks, forging receipts for extremist literature in mosques, Nicholas Bowles, he was also a Bullingdon Club member, as was Stephen Hilton, the Director of Strategy for Cameron and the godfather of Cameron and his children. So it does seem like we're almost being run by the Bullingdon Club.
Yes, but do you think through the Bullingdon Club it makes them more powerful than they would otherwise be? Or, I mean, it strikes me, I don't, you know, that likely they would have this... the country is being run by an elite, you know, and so there's various articles in the papers at the moment about there's this reversion to toffs running the country, but considering the mess of the last 13 years, a lot of people think, well, you know, can't we, and there, you know, the poor have got poorer anyway under the last government. So I kind of sense there's a feeling of, well, you know, how could it get worse?
Wasn't almost, New really? Labour just Tory light? I mean, Blair was quite happy to say that he was following in Thatcher's footsteps.
Yeah, sure.
But there's another secret club involved with the current cabinet, the Bilderbergers, and this is something which Kenneth Clark is actually the main person for the UK, and George Osborne went along to these Bilderberg meetings too. So it'd be interesting to see if, when the Bilderberg conference meets in secret at the beginning of June, quite where Kenneth Clark's loyalties lie. Do they loyal? Is he going to go to this Bilderberg meeting, or is he going to stay in London? We'll see.
Mm.
Well, thanks for interviewing me about that, Trevor.
Okay, Tony. Pleasure. Thank you.
Another 60s track now. This is the Beatles with A Hard Day's Night.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm
me sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I feel alright. You know I feel alright.
That was the Beatles with A Hard Day's Night.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is by Anthea Page. It's an interview with Anthony and Alison Smith. In 1964, the pair were paid by the BBC to be themselves in a documentary produced by John Borman to launch BBC Two. The documentary covers 5 months centred around their flat in Clifton, and it ends with Alison giving birth to twin girls at the end of May 1964. Anthony was a writer and Alison was a student at Bristol University. The documentary The Newcomers was in reality a film, not so much about the Smiths, but about the post-war generation growing up in the 60s. Through the eyes of the Smiths, we see the city of Bristol emerging with the new welfare state, the University of Bristol opening up their doors to a wider class of people, and the cultural revolution of music and fashion. The Newcomers was one of the events in the Festival of Ideas happening right across the summer at the Watershed and the Arnold Feeney.
Well, I'm here in the Watershed Cinema and I've just seen 3 episodes of The Newcomers. It's a documentary produced by John Borman. And I'm here with Anthony Smith, who was the main star of the film with his wife, Alison. Can you tell us what it was like working with John Borman?
It was immensely interesting to learn how television worked, how things were put together. I knew next to nothing about that before we started. And we were paid. I mean, it was a year's income, so it was not a bad way to earn your living for a year, especially at a time when you're having your first children, and, you know, it's a bit worrying about income. It had its, I won't say its dark side, but its difficult side, in that we were representing ourselves. You know, we were the eyes through which Borman was looking at the city of Bristol. But it wasn't fly on the wall. He didn't just let life happen and film what he wanted and stick it together as a film. He had his ideas about what he wanted to see and therefore what we had to do. And so we eventually found ourselves playing the parts of ourselves, saying words that were scripted, making moves, expressing, you know, facial expressions that were required for the story. And so we got very edgy about it towards the end because it began to feel very unreal. I think that's just a personal whinge because the films, in the end, you said we're the stars. Well, it's nice of you to say that. But the star is the city of Bristol. I mean, that's what the films are really about. And we're just the mechanism through which he can look at what he really wants to look at in Bristol.
The film's set in 1964, which was a significant time for the BBC. They were just starting out BBC Two with, and I believe Hugh Weldon came to your flat.
Yes, he did. He was head of documentaries then. And this was the first big thing on BBC Two, which is why Borman had already been working for BBC One for some years. And then suddenly there was a second channel and he wanted to make a mark on it. And so he went for this very ambitious project of 3.25 hours of film about one city with two unknown people being the pairs of eyes through which he was looking at it. Weldon took a great personal interest in the series, and you're right, he came down and talked to us, and I remember a conversation I had with him where I probably very tactlessly offered the opinion that John Motson on football was the worst thing on the BBC. And he said, have you heard Peter West on rugby? I think I can tell that story now because neither of the people is still alive.
Tell us about Tom Stoppard, because he featured a lot in the films, and I don't think many people realise he actually worked in Bristol.
Oh, he grew up here. I mean, he has a complicated backstory in his life where he was born in Czechoslovakia and then the war broke out and he went via Singapore to India. But he came to Bristol when he was 8 and so grew up here. He wasn't interested in going to university. The moment he left school, he started work for the Western Daily Press. That was what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a journalist. He was absolutely starstruck by the idea of being a journalist. And he told me that before I knew him, because he started in the mid-50s, I came here in January 1960. He told me that sometime in the 1950s, he was sent out on to cover a story about a caving accident in the Mendips. I think somebody got killed. Anyway, it's a big enough story that it not only made the front page of the Western Daily Press, but it had "By Tom Stoppard" as byline on it, and that was the first time he'd ever had a byline on the front page. And he said to me, he said, as far as I was concerned, I wouldn't really have minded dying that night because he'd achieved his lifetime's ambition.
And you worked on the Evening Post as well in 1964.
I came to Bristol to work for the Evening Post, but 5 months after I came to Bristol, the merger took place between the Evening Post and the Western Daily Press, which holds to this day. And some of the Evening Post staff, and I was one of them, were moved over from the evening paper onto the morning paper.
Alison, let's bring you in now, as you're the other part of the performance, as it were. Tell us what it was like coming to Bristol. Many people at that era, they left home for the first time, went to strange cities, more people going to university. What was it like to leave your home and come to a new city?
Well, actually, I had left it before, a year earlier, because I had at least half a year between school and university, and so I had gone to Spain. So I felt quite a kind of well-travelled student compared with a lot of my contemporaries in the French department who hadn't, you know, had come straight from home. But yes, it wasn't all that strange for me, you know.
So tell us about your role in the film, because you actually give birth to the twins.
That's at the very end. You don't actually see me giving birth, I hasten to add. No, I absolutely vetoed that. that was a non-negotiable. But you do see them just after they're born, yes. I did feel that at that point that I was giving birth and not giving a performance, though Anthony, in what he said, you know, in his introduction, he felt that we were both giving a performance as we held our babies by. I don't remember feeling that at that time. I think by that time I was a mother and here were my babies and the cameras were... They were there, but I hardly noticed them.
There's a lot in the film about contrast, isn't there? Life and death with the hanging and then the birth and social contrast, social differences. Do you think social differences still exist now in Bristol?
Yes, they do. Maybe not in the same areas. I mean, areas rise and fall, as you know. Clifton spectacularly has risen. I mean, it always had posh buildings, but it didn't have posh occupants and much of a posh lifestyle in those days. Now, if you go into one of those houses, that's what you find. I'm not sure there was an area that anyone called Montpellier in those days. It was just part of St Paul's. Now it's very much the, you know, the more fashionable chunk of that part of Bristol. And I think, give it another 20 years, St Paul's will be fashionable to live in as well, because there are fine buildings there. So I think, whereas areas like Hartcliffe and Southmead, post-war housing estates, are the places now where there seem to be a lot of social problems. So things change, but it's the problems don't go away, they just move around, they change location.
How has Bristol changed for you, bringing up children?
Oh, it's a long time since I brought up any children. They're now in their 40s, of course, and they love coming back here. They have very warm memories of, you know, of their childhood in Bristol. And they have considered moving back. They now live in London, but they have considered quite seriously moving back to Bristol, and they would love to do that because of the memories that they have. And in fact, one of our daughters did decide that she and her family would come back, and they came back and stayed with us for a few months, and the children went to the local school. And I think they thought they could come back, and with their money from, you know, their London house, they could buy a nice house in Redland. And they found that they couldn't. They couldn't afford it, you know. So they've stayed where they are, really.
How strange is it seeing yourselves on the cinema with everyone looking all those years ago?
Very strange. To be honest, I think Alison will say the same thing. I was dreading it. Actually, watching it, it's not as bad as I feared. There's a few things I cringe at. I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't talked like that, you know. The interest of what I'm watching just outweighs the bits of personal embarrassment that get in the way for me.
Yes, there's a lot of embarrassment for me because I come over so smug and so upper class. I find it hard to believe I really spoke like that. But if you can set that aside, I try to, and see the films for what they are, then I can see that there's a lot of interest about Bristol in the 60s and so on.
I think what surprised me was how industrial the port was, all the smoke and the ships. I mean, it's more a tourist area now, isn't it?
Oh, but it had, you know, had another 10 years to run. I mean, that was 64, these films, and it wasn't until 74 that the port closed down. And, of course, it was because of containerisation. The port couldn't handle big ships with containers on, so they all stop at Avonmouth now. We lost, everyone knows this, we lost an enormous amount when that happened. Because in the early 60s, when those films were made, you could go into a... I remember going to a pub called the Pineapple on the Centre. I don't know if it's there anymore. And it was full of Polish sailors, and there were some Jamaicans, and occasionally timber ships were coming from Russia. I mean, it made it an amazingly cosmopolitan area, the centre of Bristol. Well, all that has totally gone, of course.
Do you feel that, Alison, that a bit of the vitality's gone from the port?
Oh, definitely, yes, from the port. Certainly has. I mean, it's turned into a tourist marina type area now, hasn't it? Which is pleasant, but it's not, hasn't got the same vigour that it used to have.
So what attracted you to Bristol in the first place? Was it the work?
No, it was a girl. I didn't know Alison when I came to Bristol. There was a girl working as a nurse in Bristol that I was very keen on, and so I found out how to get myself a job in Bristol, to be near her. And she lasted about 6 months, and Bristol has now lasted just 50 years for me, and I'm still having a love affair with it.
That's nice. What about you, Alison? Still in love with Bristol?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes. I've got friends all over Bristol. And, no, it is a love. It is a love. If you've got to live in a city, I slightly hanker more than Anthony does after the country life. But having said that, if you've got to live in a city, then Bristol is the best, as far as I know.
Well, after the interval, we're going to see the last three episodes. So, any comment on that?
No, it's 46 years since we saw these films. They were recut for BBC One in longer version. I have seen that once, but there's so much stuff here that I haven't seen since 1964. So I'm sitting back, you know, waiting to be surprised by stuff I simply don't remember.
What about you, Alison?
Well, I am looking forward to the next one, the programme 4, because that's a party that we had where there'll be a lot of people that I used to know, my, you know, friends from student days and tutors and you know, locals. And so it'd be quite nice to see them, to see them again. People I haven't seen for donkey's years. So.
Pineapple on sticks.
Oh, is it? Probably, yes. Probably.
That was The Newcomers, one of the events in the Festival of Ideas happening right across the summer at the Watershed and the Arnolfini. Malcolm Greaves now reads this week's instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. We'll be right back.
Secrets and Lies, unmasked by David Southwell. Money is allegedly the root of all evil, and it certainly seems to be at the core of some of the most closely guarded secrets and lies perpetrated by big business. There are legitimate reasons for large companies to keep secrets. Details about their products and future plans are market sensitive and need to be protected from their rivals and share-dealing speculators. However, it is also obvious why certain companies make so much effort to repress historical information about their business activities. Greed. The reasons why IBM does not want its customers reminded of its role in the Holocaust, and why Bacardi does not want its drinkers to know how an ex-boss funded the CIA, gangsters and terrorists intent on bringing down Fidel Castro, is money. Activities from the past such as this could have a huge impact on their corporate reputations, and therefore their profits. This probably also accounts for why Coca-Cola doesn't tell the full story of the creation of Fanta or Coke on their website. From Microsoft paying leading journalists to write seemingly objective reviews of its products, to the Ford Motor Company covering up its safety record, our culture not only permits big business to get away with lying to us, we almost expect them to do it. We know deep down that the majority of ads we see on TV contain untruths, and that the major corporations wrote the book on media manipulation and spin, yet we rarely challenge it. On its corporate website, the Coca-Cola Company fact sheet for Fanta proclaims it a favourite in Europe since the 1940s. Strangely, there is no mention of the drink's origins or why it was so popular in Europe, thereby neatly glossing over all of the more interesting history of the product. Before the Second World War, Coca-Cola's strongest foreign success was in Germany, where their operations had gone from 243,000 cases sold in 1934 to shifting almost 4.5 million cases by 1939. Having achieved a position of popularity in Germany, the man running Coca-Cola GmbH, Max Keith, found himself with a problem when the war interrupted supplies of the necessary ingredients to make the famous Coca-Cola syrup. Having let Coke HQ in Atlanta know that he would do his best to keep the business running in Germany and the Nazi-occupied territories in the rest of Europe, Keith set his employees the task of creating a new drink, which was eventually named Fanta. Despite containing everything from cheese to apple fibre in its earliest formula, Fanta was popular enough to sell more than 3 million cases throughout the Third Reich. In 1960, Coke formally acquired Fanta. If you are one of the world's richest men, running a successful company in which you hold 78% of the stock, you do not expect the banks to kick you around. Yet that is exactly what happened to Howard Hughes and his airline TWA. The hit film The Aviator has helped remind us that there was more to Howard Hughes than the paranoia and eccentricity of his later years. It also demonstrated that whatever passions he may have had for actresses such as Katharine Hepburn and Jean Harlow, the one true love of his life was flying. This affair with aircraft saw him not only design planes and set new aviation records, it also led him to buy the struggling airline Transcontinental and Western Air in 1939. Renaming it Trans World Airlines, TWA, under his leadership the company expanded rapidly, becoming a major international player by innovating over routes, customer comfort. TWA was the first airline to show movies, and the aircraft it used. Hughes took a hands-on interest in the company, even piloting some of TWA's commercial flights. In 1961, needing additional finance after investing heavily in a new fleet of aircraft, Hughes declined a loan from financial institutions due to the high interest rate and the fact that it would allow the banks 2 votes on the board, compared to his 1. In an effort to get Hughes to change his mind about the loan, a top Wall Street lawyer started a legal action against him. The plan was to wrest control of TWA from Hughes on the basis that by refusing the loan he had cost his company $45,870,435. Hughes could not believe that the company he owned was suing him for control by not taking a loan he did not want. The bitter 12-year-long case rumbled on until 1973, when Hughes was eventually vindicated in the US Supreme Court. It was a hollow victory, however, as Hughes had sold his stock for $547 million, 5 years into the case. A vast but secretive Japanese corporation sets up a laboratory to investigate telepathy, telekinesis, controlled synchronicity, and other strange powers rumoured to reside in the human but derided by nearly all scientists. They employ one of the world's top researchers into artificial intelligence, who ends up making a shattering discovery. It sounds like the setup for a PlayStation computer game. All it lacks is an indestructible cyborg villain. However, the only link to the PlayStation is that the Japanese corporation at the centre of this amazing true-life story is Sony. Sony had legitimate reasons for keeping the work of AI guru Yoshiro Sako and the Extrasensory Perception and Excitation Research Laboratory, ESPER, out of the public eye. When knowledge first became public in 1991, Yoshihiro Otsuki, a professor at Waseda University, said, "By funding psychic research, Sony might as well be saying its products cannot be trusted." Allied to this was heightened Japanese fear of all things paranormal after the 1995 sarin nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway, undertaken by the spooky Aum Shinrikyo cult. Sony founder Masahara Ibuka believed that some people have the ability to perceive beyond the five senses. The research is intended to investigate how this happens and why, and to consider the possibility of machines that would enable us to communicate telepathically. The head of the ESPER division, Yoshiro Sako, was quoted as saying, "If we can understand the mechanisms of telepathy, it would totally transform communication methods." In the summer of 1998, after 7 years of research by ESPER, Sony spokesman Manosobu Sakaguchi made an incredibly low-key announcement. He revealed two things. The first was that ESP exists. Secondly, that Sony had decided to wind down its paranormal research. Sakaguchi said, "We found out experimentally that ESP exists, but that any practical application of this knowledge is not likely in the foreseeable future." It may be fascinating to learn that, according to Sony, ESP exists. But the closure of ESPER was no surprise. After all, Sony is a business. If it cannot find a practical application for ESP, it cannot make money from it. Big businesses are rarely shy or secretive about donating thousands of tons of their goods to the developing world. Given the poor publicity many of the major drug companies have received over the prices they charge some of the poorest countries on the planet for the drugs to fight AIDS, one would expect them to be heralding their donation of pharmaceutical products. In fact, when major American pharmaceutical companies send tons of drugs to places such as Rwanda, Sudan, and Banda Aki, one of the areas that suffered the worst devastation from the Asian tsunami in 2004, the only people they might rush to tell about their generosity are the US tax authorities. Due to tax breaks offered for gifts in kind, the companies can receive significant commercial benefit from their donations, sometimes twice the cost of the drug, against their tax bill. The truth behind what on the surface seem like acts of pure altruism is that the pharmaceutical companies often donate drugs that are past their sell-by date and which would otherwise have to be incinerated at considerable cost. The process has become known as drug dumping. During the conflict in Bosnia, companies donated more than 17,000 tons of useless products such as anti-smoking devices, hair removal cream, lip balm, and slimming agents. Skipping over the insensitivity of sending diet pills to people who may be starving, it cost the Bosnian government $34 million to dispose of the unwanted and out-of-date drugs safely. Previously, the drug companies were much more gung-ho about trying to obtain publicity for their donations. This position began to change when respected organisations such as War on Want, Médecins Sans Frontières and Pharmaciens Sans Frontières began to expose how apparent acts of altruism were in fact callous, dangerous and exploitative. Drug dumping in hard-hit areas of the world continues apace, with, for instance, thousands of tons of unwanted drugs being shipped to areas devastated by the Asian tsunami in 2004.
Thank you, Malcolm Greaves, for that excellent reading of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Now I'm rejoined by Trevor Carter. Our resident bard is here to give you, and us, and everyone, his latest poem. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Tony.
What have we got this week, then?
This week we've got At the Top of the Stairs. I wrote this actually before the election, and it's kind of about PR.
So, but it's public relations or proportional representation,
yes. Okay. But it's kind of in a slightly odd context of when I was on holiday, and I was still kind of half thinking about it. So it's called At the Top of the Stairs. At the top of some stairs, there's an old foreign flat. You can walk up the stairs and get away from all that's going on back at home. And the flat has a view, so you forget all about home and the things there to do. You have to do certain things with things going on, and the future's uncertain, and there is a lot that is wrong with the way that things are. And you think who'll get in, and how, with things as they are now, can anyone win? Yes, I think we can't win till we all change the game, and that's what I think, and that's why I came to the top of the stairs of the old foreign flat, where I climb up the stairs in my holiday hat. In my holiday hat, I can take in the views. In my holiday hat, I can ignore all the news of the things that are wrong, though they won't go away, and so maybe it's wrong to be sat here today. But I'm sat here today, and here's where I sit, and it's fine sitting here now, so I'll sit here a bit at the top of the stairs, where I think, change the rules, then we'd all have fairer shares, not just games made for fools. And it makes us seem fools, as not all our votes count. Still, that is the fixed rules that we cannot surmount, as the system is fixed. So we all have our cares, and this is the fixed view from the top of the stairs. There are old schools of thought who have sought to maintain, and have argued we ought to maintain the same game with its rules still the same. And they say change is bad, and they chant the same song that still sounds very sad. I've written too much to put on a postcard, but I've written it now, and it's caught me off guard just how much I've said just about this and that from the top of some stairs in an old foreign flat.
Thank you, Trevor. So you're a big fan of proportional representation, then?
Well, yes, in a word, yes. Yeah, I think it's an essential step in the for improving democracy.
Okay, lovely. Yes. Thanks very much for joining us this week. He tells me he's not a plainclothes policeman. He tells me he's not a banker or a gnome of Zurich. But he does know what's on next week. Jeff.
Thank you. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 28th of May, the all-female Metallica tribute group, Metallica, will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Moving into Saturday 29th of May, Choker will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. On Sunday 30th of May, the John E. Vistick Experience will be performing with support from Countryside at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I pay tribute to Ronnie James Dio. He performed with bands such as Elf, Rainbow, Black Sabbath, Heaven and Hell, and his own band Dio. He passed away on May the 16th, 2010, aged 67. This is from the album Richie Blackmore's Rainbow, which was released in 1975, and is a track titled If You Don't Like Rock and Roll.
Blinding.
That was Rainbow with If You Don't Like Rock and Roll from the album Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. Also on Sunday, 30th of May, the founder of Fleetwood Mac, Peter Green, will be performing at the Cheese and Grain in Frome. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £21 in advance and £25 on the door. On Monday, 31st of May, Steve Payne and Char Baby will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 7 p.m. and tickets are £3 each, which you can purchase at the venue. Finally, on Monday, 31st of May, Devil Sold His Soul will be performing with support from The Boy Would Drown and also Merrick at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That was the elegant Jeffrey Sparks bringing the Dialect Radio to a close. Studio guest this week was Glenn Vowles. Malcolm Grieve read Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Features were by Anthea Page and the poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. The studio engineer this week was Johnny Royden. You can check out the Festival of Ideas at the Watershed and Arnold Feeney websites. The festival's attracting a lot of well-known personalities, talking about a variety of interesting subjects. There's a diverse range of lectures and panel debates with commentators on all subjects at the moment. The producer this week was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Tony Gosling. That was Dialect, and we'll be back the same time next week.